Counseling and Referral. You have a problem, maybe I can help you. By Father Joseph C. Martin. Father Martin.
Always after a good meal, I'm putting mine in. This is a magnificent story about two English kids. They were born next door to each other and grew up together. They were great rivals. Tremendous rivals. Two brilliant, brilliant kids. And at the end of every year, you know, the report cards would come out, and one year one of them would be like a half of a point above the other. And it was this way all through their careers. One went to Oxford, one went to Cambridge. Same way through their university days. They were almost parallel all the way through. Well, they each graduated. And the last they saw of each other was on the day of graduation. One went into the Anglican Navy, one went into the Anglican priesthood. The English Navy and the Anglican priesthood. Anyways, again, they were great rivals. Their talent, of course, catapulted each one of them to the top. As the years went by, the Navy officer ultimately achieved the rank of High Admiral of the British Navy. And the other man, as the years went by, made it to the top. He became Archbishop Canterbury. Well, in one peculiarity, the Archbishop grew not only in age and grace and wisdom before God and man, but also in girth. He gave birth to a huge pot belly. He was a gigantic man. Now, neither had seen the other all these years. Neither knew what the other looked like. Quite by accident, after 31 years of being separated, they met. Now, the only contact they had, each one would mail the other a Christmas card at Christmas and would sign it with his name, comma, and then the latest promotion, underlined. They met in a train station. And here's the British Admiral in all of his finery. He was covered with more brass than you can imagine. He had medals and ribbons and braid all over him. And the Archbishop is there, huge, in his flowing red cassock, and he spotted the Admiral first. And I went up to him, he tapped him on the shoulder. Of course, when the Admiral turned around, he was shocked. He recognized his old buddy immediately, see? But before he could say anything, the Archbishop looked at his uniform and said, "Porter, would you put my bag on that train over there?" And the old Admiral took a reading on this gigantic figure in front of him. Huge belly, flowing red robe, and he said, "Madam, in your condition, you shouldn't be traveling at all." Actually, that doesn't have anything to do with anything. I just thought I'd tell that. Well, anyways, I'd like to begin this afternoon by simply offering a little information as a result of a suggestion. At the end of the last talk, someone said, there may be those who would question the fact that, you said the only place to learn about alcoholism is from alcoholics. If I gave that impression, I did not intend to. All other things being equal, I maintain that the best teacher is the one who has the edge of experience. That's all I meant. So please understand the context in which I said it. There are many knowledgeable men and women in the field of alcoholism who have not suffered the disease themselves. And there are many who, in my opinion, are far more qualified than many recovered alcoholics. I didn't mean that at all. I simply mean that all other things being equal, an alcoholic has the edge of his own experiential knowledge that he has picked up from having been there. Okay, guideline number 4. Confront the alcoholic with the fact of his illness. Now, ladies and gentlemen, immediately there comes a kind of conflict in the minds of many between AA's reticence and this guideline in going out to help the alcoholic. And for those of you who are members of AA, I would simply say this. as an organization, AA attracts rather than promotes. This is one of its traditions. And so AA as an organization doesn't go out and lasso drunks off of bar stools and slam them into meetings. Let's all acknowledge that. What I'm saying is that the 12th step of AA therapy, in order to retain one's sobriety, one must share it, and one must do this actively rather than passively. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. This is a teaching of Bill Wilson, the man who started it all. With that as a preface, the alcoholic has deceived, of all people, he has deceived himself most. Any alcoholic who says anything out loud ultimately believes it. And when he says, I don't have a problem, he believes that, even though the whole world knows it. And many an alcoholic will literally go to his grave believing that no one knows anything about his drinking because nobody said anything. Nobody has said anything. And so we confront the alcoholic with the fact of his illness. You have a drinking problem. Now, I'd like to make a few comments about this confrontation. I would strongly suggest that it makes no sense at all to point out a problem unless you can point out its solution. I want to tell you something about myself. I have learned this after many years. The day I get too old to learn, I'm just too old. But I also know this. If you have something to say to me that is a correction or a reprimand, please say it with love. There are two people in my life. When they talk, I listen. One's a man, one's a woman. And I listen for this reason. They love me enough that they tell me what is wrong with me only that I might profit from it. I know this so that when they do, I do two things. I thank them and I act on it. And if you care enough about me to want me to be a better person and you offer me a correction that will indeed be embarrassing or painful or shameful or whatever, I'll do two things to you. I'll thank you and I'll act on it. Took me a long, long time to arrive at that. But don't you dare come up to me and just say, you have this wrong with you. If you can't offer me a solution to it, I'm going to know two things about you. Number one, you're moralizing. Number two, you're condescending. And number three, you're going to learn something about me. I ain't going to be listening. I'm going to be busy bending over to pick up a club to apply to your skull. It means absolutely nothing to go up to a man who is dying of alcoholism and say, you have a problem with your drinking. Unless you can say, and I know where you can get help and I'll take you there. Now when you can add that, he might be listening. I don't know whether he will or not. But for God's sake, don't confront him unless you can give him the answer to his problem. This is where it pays to go to some AA meetings, because you will know where to take him. And you might be willing to take him there. How should the confrontation be made? Watch this for a perfect cop-out answer. Properly. Ain't that a beauty? What's that mean? Well, what it means is by the right person with the right words in the right place and at the right time. Now, what's the answer to that? I don't know. If I had the answer to that, I could save a nation. But I know this, what is proper for one is not for another. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a purely judgmental thing. And it takes great prudence, common sense, and experience. And then, in 4 out of 5 cases, you will be cursed for your pains. But you see, let's go back to guideline 3, alcohol controls him. If you know that, you know what his reaction will probably be, and you'll come to expect it. Why do alcoholics lie? Why do they meet a confrontation with hostility and everything else? Because this is all a threat to his drinking. Now, these hints that I have picked up from other people, and I'm about to go over with you now, for gosh sake, they are general statements. Please realize that. They are general statements. Any general statement brooks of exceptions. So, number one, you normally don't talk to an alcoholic when he's drunk. He's all drugged up. It's the same thing as in that chalk talk. I said it doesn't make any sense for a doctor to try to apply psychiatric therapy to somebody that's half drugged with ether. Just doesn't make sense. Same way with the alcoholic when he's drunk. And I honestly believe that very rarely do you approach an alcoholic when he's sober, because he's there with two fielder's mitts. He's been ready for years for whatever comes his way to field him and throw him back and so on. Many an alcoholic can just zing people around his little finger when he's sober. You talk to many an alcoholic about his drinking when he's sober, and in 2 minutes, he'll give you enough reasons for his drinking, you're just liable to say, wait, I'll get my hat and go with you. When then do you approach an alcoholic? Suggestion? When he's in pain. When he's hurting. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that every one of us in this room has read somewhere along the line pamphlets or books on human motivation. One thing motivates alcoholics to get well. It's the cleanest four-letter word in English. P-A-I-N. And what's the principle behind it? When you hurt bad enough to want to quit hurting, then you'll do something to stop the pain. This is a little bit of general American history that most people don't know. You know that toilet seat that is, it's built like a horseshoe, you know, it has that opening in the front? Most toilet seats are built that way. That was invented by an alcoholic. He got tired of getting hit in the back of the neck. When you hurt bad enough to want to quit hurting, you will do something to stop the pain. They cut that section out. Boom. Down it comes. It's true, though. Many people say, well, the alcoholic will get well when he wants to. There's only one thing that's going to make him want to, and that's pain. Now, the pain can be of many kinds. The least is physical. Alcoholics go through hell after hell of physical pain and go back for more. I'm talking about the mental and the emotional pain that results from years of drinking. I'm talking about a conscience that is in such pain that very rarely can the alcoholic tolerate even a bit of sobriety, because then his conscience would kill him. In some, it is a thing called soul sickness. Soul sickness. Ask any alcoholic. He has usually reached a point in his drinking career when he is given probably God's greatest gift to the human being. He looks into a mirror and has an overwhelming desire to puke because he can't stand what he's looking at. That's the pain, the gut pain, that brings most alcoholics to their knees. And ultimately it proves to be God's greatest gift. Someday I'd like to come back and just talk about pain. There's a great deal to be said about it. Maybe someday. Anyways, do you know of any alcoholic who busted out of bed on a beautiful summer day and said, gee, it's a lovely day, I think I'll go to AA from a drinking problem? Nobody comes into treatment that way. Every alcoholic is forced into it by one means or another. I humbly submit for your consideration that for the three or four alcoholics who offer hostility to a confrontation, there's the alcoholic who has been waiting for it for 1, 2, or 5, or 15 years. What alcoholic is going to bust up to a stranger or even a friend and say, look, I think I have a drinking problem. What can you do to help me? No alcoholic does that except by way of rare exception. And so we confront him. You have a drinking problem. Now, again, this depends a great deal on prudence, common sense, and experience. What are the right words? I don't know. I know one man whose life was saved by his son, the right person, with the right words at exactly the right moment. This man piddled around the edges of treatment for 14 years. He had three kids, two daughters and a son, and he worshipped them. And he absolutely idolized this boy. And my old buddy was a sloppy drunk. He came home drunk one night. And the boy, to show you how balanced this kid was, how exceptional he was, he graduated in the top five of a class of 500 in the University of Maryland's law school some years ago. Anyway, he was studying one night. He was in college. And the old man came home. He said, "Hi, Jake." And the boy didn't even lift his head up from his book. He just raised his eyes. He looked at his father and he said three words. He said, "Dad, you stink." And old Nels got well. It was the right person at exactly the right moment, and he used exactly the right words. And you and I know of other men and women who have been told that thousands of times and died drunk. I don't know what the right words are. This is no magic wand sort of a thing. I know this for those of you who are married to alcoholics who are still at it. Al-Anon will teach this. Never make a threat you don't intend to carry out. I heard of one case. This was in the beginnings of AA. A rather prominent psychiatrist went to some meetings, and his little wife went with him. And he continued to drink, but he felt that going to these meetings was keeping her off of his back and so on. She hung around long enough to find out that the answer was here if he wanted it. Well, he kept drinking and kept drinking and kept drinking. He came home one night. He was one of these happy-go-lucky drunks. Walked in the house with a big grin on him. She's packed. All the bags were packed. And the grin disappeared. And he said, "What's this?" He was a great, huge giant of a man. She was a little bit of a thing. He just worshipped the ground near which she walked. He absolutely adored her. And when he said, "What's this?" his wife walked up to him. Her chin came up to his belt buckle, you know. She's a little bit of a thing. She put her finger under his nose and said these words. She has never used this word before and has never used it since. She simply said, "You big Irish son of a bitch, you take one more drink and I go and those bags go with me." And he knew that she meant it. And he got well. He got well. I know many other people who have been threatened that way and died drunk. I don't know what works. I don't know what works. I only know this, that true love is usually tough. True love is usually tough. To do the things that need to be done because you care, it takes great love and great maturity to do this.